Well, one piece of business before we get started. I and some of the other pastors have been talking about things that we would like to do. And one of the, over the summer, a joint Bible plan as of right now, we're going to meet on, I think it's the 23rd. So that's next Wednesday. We're going to get together, the other pastors and I and the Ministerial Association pastors. And we're going to have a meeting about what this is going to look like. But here's what we're kind of thinking. We're not sure what day of the week we want to do it. And maybe what we'll do is kind of survey our churches. But our plan is to do it in the park in the evenings. And we're going to do the church like that. So even though it's going to be around supper time, it'll also be the meal will be provided. And then everybody, all the pastors kind of have a big, kind of more of a fun thing. But our plan is, as of right now, is to finish in June, or is to start in June. We're going to do the book of Ephesians, is what we're thinking, but that's going to take us, we figured all of the summer we'll get through Ephesians, so we're thinking maybe June through September we can probably do it. We're not, anyways, details will be forthcoming, but what that means is, for us, we've got April, May, and the next couple weeks in March to finish up Revelation, which I think is really doable. So I just wanted to let you guys know ahead of time. We're here in chapter 14. We've got 14, 15, bad at counting. And so we've got this many more books of Revelation to do. We've got 9 more books, and we've got probably about 10 more weeks or around there to go. So here's what we'll probably do is we'll try to move through the material. We're not going to hurry through, but we're going to be moving at a steady click. And if there's anything left over, like if there's for some reason anything we can't finish before June, we're not going to hold it over until the fall because that really wouldn't get us anywhere. So what we'll do is I'll probably record some stuff and put it on the church website. Not that I don't enjoy meeting with you guys, but I don't want to be running multiple things simultaneously, and you guys are already giving up time, and so if you want to be part of that, my goal is going to be to try to finish this up before June, and that way we can, that way we'll be ready to go. So tonight we're in chapter 14, and I think that we can probably make it all the way through 14 tonight. 14, 15, 16, maybe 17, we might be able to do again in one night. Now, we spent quite a while in chapter 12. We spent quite a while in chapter 11. But last week, we did chapter 13 in one week. These next couple chapters, I think, are going to be fairly simple. But if it gets to the place where you guys really want to keep talking about whatever the material is, don't let me just push through. I know I'm trying to move at a fairly quick clip. But let's not ignore stuff that seems significant to you. So, starting in chapter 14, and I think what we'll do is we're going to read the first 5 verses. We'll go over the material, and then we'll work through the next, maybe probably 6 through 12, and then maybe 13 through 20 or 13 through 16. We'll see. All right, so chapter 14, reading from my translation. You can read out of whatever you want. Beginning in verse 1, and I saw, and behold, the Lamb stood upon the Mount Zion, and with him were 144,000, having his name and the name of his Father written upon their foreheads. And I heard a voice out of heaven, like the voice of many waters, and like a voice of great thunder. And the voice which I heard was like harpers harping in their harps. And they sang like a new song before the throne and before the four living things and the elders. And no one was able to learn the song except the 144,000, which are bought from the earth. These are the ones that were not defiled with women, for they are virgins. These the ones following the Lamb wherever he should depart. These were bought from the men, first fruits to God and the Lamb, and in their mouths a falsehood is not found. They are blameless. Okay, again, I know that my translation is really hard to follow. It's not because it's made for reading for pleasure. It's made to draw things literally out of the Greek text that you aren't going to get out of a good modern translation. So we start here. Now remember where we were in chapter 13. Basically, we see the seventh trumpet is blown. We have chapter 12. We have this extended discussion of the woman and the dragon. chapter 13, we are in the beast out of the sea and the beast out of the earth. So we've had Satan pointed out to us, who's cast out of heaven. We have the beast out of the sea pointed out to us, who is typically understood as the Antichrist. And then the beast out of the earth, who is typically understood as the false prophet. So we have the unholy trinity. We've got Satan, the false father. We've got the beast out of the sea, who is the false Christ. And we have the beast out of the earth, who is the false Holy Spirit, or the false prophet. Then, so we see all this at the end of chapter 13. We see that he has a number. Now, what stands out to you guys? So remember chapter, this is kind of a tough week to go from not reading chapter 13 right into 14, because this is definitely a section where you want to keep your rolling. But what stands out to you guys as we read these first five verses? What is really, so your first observation is that they are, the 144,000 have the name of the Father written upon their foreheads, which we'll get to in just a second. That's a very good observation. And then you see this comparison. So they're bought from the earth, they're bought from men. And so I think that that's a really good comparison, and that's really good theologically for when we read the Bible. When we see the same expression used with different terms, typically we're supposed to understand those things as synonymous. So when he says they're bought from among men, or they're bought out of men, or they're bought from the earth or out of the earth, we're supposed to understand. Now, that's one way, is to see those as synonymous. Another way to interpret those, and I'm being, like, full disclosure, another way is to say, no, they're not synonyms. We're supposed to understand each of them independently. So this is where the way you read the Bible makes a difference, and it's not a major difference. I mean, it's not going to, nobody's theology is hanging on these verses, right? But this is a long-standing question in interpretation, is when we see stuff like this, do we try to harmonize, or do we say, well, no, they're two different terms, they're used in close proximity, so maybe they're referring to two different ideas. That maybe we shouldn't just assume that they mean the same thing. And there are good arguments to be made both ways. And I personally tend to take the position that, well, maybe they can both be true. Maybe they are synonymous, and maybe they do have subtle differences. Maybe we're supposed to read it both ways. And theologians don't really like that. Bible scholars don't like it. When you say it's both and, that doesn't make them happy. They want it to be one thing or another, and that really makes people uncomfortable. But that's a good observation. Thank you for pointing that out. Those are the things that when we do those more often, it makes us better students of the Bible. Being a careful reader and noticing different terminology is going to make us better readers. What else stands out to you guys? Things that, yeah. Yeah, so the... Yeah, so the expression, do you remember exactly which upon their foreheads? The key, is that verse 1? Okay. Back in chapter 13, do you remember what verse that is? Yeah, the word, the Greek word is epi. Now, I don't have the text here that they use to translate the King James, so I don't know, but here's what is true, and this is I'm not saying the King James is wrong. Prepositions in foreign languages, if you've studied a foreign language, you know how hard prepositions are to understand. Greek has a preposition that's really common, spell it in English. And in can mean in, into, on, by. So it could be that the textus receptus that the King James uses here, it may be that it has the word en rather than epi. It may have a different Greek preposition, so I can't. Yeah, with this translation saying in doesn't really make, with the Greek text I have, that doesn't make a lot of sense, but I don't know what, I don't. Yeah, some things that are worth, to me, that stand out, obviously, or did you have something? Okay, so I'll give you a quick review, because you were out gallivanting around in Tennessee, so you missed some things, but really quick review, if in my timeline, the way I think is the best read this is when you look at the end of chapter 11, the two witnesses are there, and there's an earthquake in Israel. That's verse 13. There's an earthquake in Jerusalem, and the people repent. I think that is the fulfillment of Ezekiel 37, where Israel becomes a live nation. I think that's where all Israel is saved, so that would also correspond to Romans somewhere in 9 through 11. All Israel is saved at this point. This is the 3.5 year period of the tribulation. This is when Antichrist breaks his treaty of peace with Israel because Israel has rejected him. So this would also correspond to Matthew, Mark chapter, where there's the abomination of desolation spoken of by the prophet Daniel. Israel goes out, and we see that kind of being played out in chapter 12. And then that's why part of, I think that's part of the, start to emphasize Antichrist again. Even though he's been mentioned before, we emphasize him again because this is where he's fulfilling Daniel chapter 11, where he's got the, I'm not seeing where the 144,000 are. What exactly? Chapter 14, verse 1. And I saw, and behold, the Lamb stood upon Mount Zion, and with him were 144,000, having his name and the name of their father written upon their foreheads. And I heard a voice out of heaven, like the voice of many waters, is like harpers harping in their harps. And they sang a new song, 4,000. I mean, I don't see them being taken up to heaven right here. It's clear, there's clearly not clear who's speaking here. We may have a change in speaker. We may, because there's a voice, and a voice comes out of heaven. And it's like harpers harping their harps. But that's a singular. All of that is singular. So the voice like harpers harping their harps, and then they sang. What is that? The harpers harping their harps sing a new song. Or is that the 144,000? I admit you're right. It's very unclear where the 144,000 are at this point, because it does sound like, depending on how you read it, they could. I mean, they're on Mount Zion in verse 1. But verse 3 makes it kind of sound like they're in heaven. They're bought from the earth, which doesn't necessarily mean they're not in the earth. It could just mean out of, from amongst the earth, they're bought. So I see what you're saying. It is unclear. And again, that's something that's really unclear, because if the Lamb is standing here, then there seems to be a big... There's definitely something different that happens in chapter 19, but here the Lamb is standing upon Mount Zion. And yeah, I'll be honest with you, I don't really know. I wish I had a better answer. I think it's probably not a good answer to say that they are in a heavenly Mount Zion. Now, here's what could be happening. And I'll throw this out here. What could be happening is that we're getting things that are a little bit out of order. It could be he's seeing, again, this picture of the 144,000, which we saw back in chapter, was it 7? So we see the 144,000 sealed in chapter 7. We see the multitude in white robes of the Gentiles in chapter 7. So this is not the first time we've seen them. Now, they're sealed, but again, back in chapter 7, I think it might have been Connie pointed out a while ago that it's kind of unclear whether they're alive or dead. It seems the normal reading seems to be that they're alive, but then there's also stuff where it maybe sounds like they're martyred for their testimony in chapter 7. So it's not really clear. Here's what let's do. Let's go ahead and take a pause right here, because sometimes John is helpful. When we have something that's really unclear, John is helpful. If we continue to read, maybe he clarifies it. I'll be honest, I don't really know where to place these guys, because we've got several different subjects. We have the voice out of heaven. Now, the voice out of heaven, like many waters, sounds like Jesus, because that's exactly how Jesus is described back in chapter 1. But that voice is coming out of heaven. So how is he standing upon Mount Zion with 144,000? That's kind of weird, right? And then the voice is like harpers harping in their harps. Okay, the harps are going to become significant later, but, and then they sang, the harpers are singing a new song, and no one was able to learn the song except the 144,000. So are the 144,000 the harpers, or are the 144,000 people who were able to learn the song of the harpers? Does that make sense to you guys? Because you could read it both ways. You could read that as the 144,000 were the voice of the Lamb, which no problem theologically there. Like the church being the voice of God, no theological issue. That's clearly good Johannine theology. But no one's able to learn it except the 144,000. Did they learn it? Are they the voice of the harpers? Or did they learn it from the voice of the Lamb and they're now singing the same song on earth that was sung in heaven? And when it says that the Lamb stood upon Mount Zion with the 144,000, again, whatever this means, it sounds like the 144,000. Notice the great multitude of Gentiles isn't mentioned here. The 144,000 have gathered on Mount Zion. And that's kind of what it sounds like in Matthew and Mark and Luke, right? When this happens, flee to the mountains. When you see the abomination of desolation, flee to the mountains. And the Lamb is standing upon them with them. Okay? You could skirt around that by saying, well, he wasn't physically there with them. He was with them in spirit. That doesn't really satisfy me in the book of Revelation, but we've got a possibility there. But then the voice comes out of heaven, and that sounds like Jesus' voice. So, this is tough. Now, verse 4, again, is kind of reiterating the material. Verses 4 and 5, I'm sorry, are reiterating the material that we got in chapter 7 when it was describing who these people are. So that's John's way of saying, hey, did you forget these 140,000? Remember, this was not written out for everybody to have a written copy for them to read. Part of ancient writing, especially biblical writing, is it's got to be repetitious so that people can hear it and remember it. They can follow the story just by hearing it. Okay, so let's look at verses. Let's just do 6 through 8. Let's take a small bite-sized chunk here. And I saw another angel flying in mid-heaven, having an age-old good news to good news upon the ones sitting upon the earth and upon every nation and tribe and tongue and people, and saying in a great voice, fear God and give him glory, because the hour of his judgment came, and worship the one who made the heaven and the earth and the sea and the fountains of water. And another angel, a second, followed, saying, it fell, Babylon the great, which out of the wine of the passion of her fornication all the nations have drunk. And another angel, a third, followed them, saying in a great voice, let's just pause right there. Okay, so we've got this angel flying in mid-heaven. Now, we've had the eagle flying in mid-heaven before, if you guys remember, and we discussed whether it should actually be an eagle or an angel, because there are Greek texts that seem to have both words. But now we have fallen as Babylon the Great. Okay, now maybe we're not in as much trouble as we thought. Because what we see, if we go forward to chapter 19, that's when Jesus returns. Everybody agrees Jesus returns in chapter 19. But what's in chapter 18? The fall of Babylon. After this, I saw another angel coming down from heaven. He had great authority, and the earth was illuminated by his splendor. With a mighty voice, he shouted, fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. Okay, well, wait a minute. Here in chapter 14, verse 8, I guess I forgot to put a number in there. In verse 8, we have Babylon is fallen. Chapter 18, verse 2, Babylon is fallen. And it's an angel declaring it. So, one of two things is happening. One of three things is happening. One, Jesus makes multiple returns back to the earth during the revelation. Not just the rapture, but he makes multiple physical returns to the earth. That's possible. Most people don't really like that, but we'll say it's possible, right? That could be what John is telling us. Two, there could be multiple falls of Babylon. Maybe Babylon falls, and then they rebuild themselves, and then they fall again. Third option, these could be two Babylons that are being referred to. So a lot of people refer to, when they read it, they talk about mystery Babylon and commercial Babylon. Have you guys ever heard those terms? So when we read through there, there's mystery Babylon the Great. So people talk about mystery Babylon, which is the false church, and commercial Babylon, which is a city, and people say commercial Babylon might be Rome or Jerusalem or Washington, D.C. or New York or whatever. So that's another option. Or a fourth option, it's just me throwing this out there, a fourth option is maybe what we're getting here in chapter 14 is either a flash forward. So chapter 12 mostly is right there in the timeline, except we have a small flashback in verse 12, right? In chapter 12, we go back to the birth of the church. So that's at least, or Jesus, that's at least a flashback of some kind. So maybe we have a flash forward, or, here's another option, or John lays out the conclusion that there's the beast out of the earth, and he has his number, and he gives us, which is kind of a flash forward, but he gives us the conclusion that Babylon has fallen, and then he gives us a flashback to where we normally are, and then he tells us how Babylon... Let's keep reading and see if any of this makes sense. So let me pause here and ask, is there anything here in verses 6 through 8 that makes you guys say, yeah, like, I think this is really interesting, or whatever. Depending on where you have, there is that other angel flying in mid-heaven, and I think that's, it could be, depending on the translation, it could be the eagle, because I think that's with the woes, right? So I know where the first woe is there in chapter 12. Verse 12. I'm looking for the woe, where we see three woe. I don't remember where it is, but yeah, that term mid-heaven, I don't remember exactly where it is, but anything else that stands out to you guys that we want to make sure that we talk about? Notice the parallelisms as well. So we looked back in chapter 13, and we mentioned in chapter 13 that everything Satan is doing is a cheap imitation of what God has already done. Right, so he makes them get the stamp on their the mark on their hands or on their foreheads of 666, but that's just a cheap copy of the sealing that the 144,000 had received. Right, we see that people of every tribe, tongue, nation, and people are supposed to worship the beast, but we've already seen that language referring to Jesus. But now back in chapter 14, we see a repetition of those themes. So part of what's happening is, John wants us to remember, hey, what's going on is Antichrist is mirroring and mimicking what God is doing. There's also, because these themes keep repeating, it's supposed to make us feel the antagonism. Right? It's kind of like, who is the two people, the old skit, anything you can do, I can do better. Was that Fred Astaire and... Do you know who? Yeah, so it's yeah, I feel like that should... Ginger Rogers was the girl who danced with Fred Astaire a lot, but anyways. Yeah, if anybody can think of that, let me know. But it's supposed to feel this back and forth, where we see these same terms being repeated for Jesus, Antichrist, Christ, Antichrist, Christ, Antichrist. So it's supposed to give us that feel of this tension. So anyways, that might be something worth thinking about. And the angel has the age-old gospel to gospel upon the ones who are on the earth. Fear God and give Him glory. And now notice, if the Bible, again, I've said this 1,000 times, maybe not 1,000, but I've said it a bunch, I'll keep saying it. The book of Revelation rewards those who pay attention, like all great literature. Fear God and give Him glory. What does this mean? This seems to be, if we look at verse 6, he has the gospel to give the gospel to the ones upon the earth, to everybody. This angel is giving the gospel to everybody. And what's the gospel? Fear God and glorify Him. Well, wait a minute. We've already seen this term. Where have we seen this term? Well, go back to chapter 11. What happens in chapter 11? Well, at the end of chapter 11, I'm sorry, I shouldn't say the end, in verse 13, what happens? The survivors in Jerusalem, what did they do? They were feared, they were afraid, and they glorified the God of heaven. So this is another clue. John is a good writer. John uses his vocabulary consistently. So we can now interpret backwards. We couldn't do this before because we hadn't read this yet, but we can now interpret backwards and say, oh, wait a minute, we've seen these terms before. So since chapter 14, verse 7 tells us that, 6 and 7 tells us that receiving the gospel, saying yes to Jesus, means fearing God and giving Him glory. Now we know that the remainder of the survivors in chapter 11 received the gospel. They became believers. How do we know? Because the same terms are used. They feared and they gave glory. Fear God, give Him glory. right? So do you guys have, yeah, anyways, any questions? Yeah, absolutely. Well, but see, here's the thing, and I agree with you. I agree with you 100%. But people want to nitpick every little thing, and sometimes that's not the worst thing in the world. But because we should be careful with what we say. But people might say, well, maybe they were only paying him lip service. It's not an argument I would make, but you know, for sake of argument, let's say you want to push it that far. Well, at this point, you can't keep pushing it any further. It's clearly been equated with receiving the gospel here, so we can work that back, and so we can say, yes, the remainder of the people of Jerusalem have received the gospel, at least, maybe not all Israel, in the sense of every Jew who's alive in the world at that time, but everybody in the city of Jerusalem who didn't die in the earthquake is now a believer. I think so. I don't think that verse chapter 11 gives us every single detail. I think that probably my guess would be that the abomination of desolation happened when this earthquake happened, and that would be my guess, is that those two events happened simultaneously, and when people saw the earthquake, they saw this blasphemy, they rejected Antichrist, and then they went and escape. Does the text require it? No, it doesn't. I mean, this could have happened over a period of time, because it just says then. It doesn't say and immediately at that second. So I tend to think it was probably. Anyways, and we get the second angel followed. So the first angel, what does the first angel do? The first angel goes and gives the gospel. It says, fear God, give him glory. And he gives the reason, because the hour of judgment came. Not even the hour of judgment is coming. The hour of his judgment came. So the tribulation is at least in some sense the hour of his judgment. Worship the one who made the heaven, the earth, and the sea, and the fountains of water. A second angel, another angel, followed, saying, it fell, Babylon the Great, which out of the wine of the passion of her fornication all the nations have drunk. Okay. So what is Babylon the Great? And what is the wine of the passion of her fornication? What does this mean? We don't know yet. John is the idea. Now, other writers, obviously, Peter particularly talks about how he wrote from Babylon. Babylon has all sorts of imagery in the Bible. It's very symbolic. Well, see, people debate that, and people dispute it. There are three major interpretations. So to answer your question, there are three major interpretations of what Babylon, well, four. There are four major interpretations of what Babylon is. One, Babylon is all false religion in the world. Okay. Two, Babylon is the actual city of Babylon. Not a lot of people really hold number two, but it's possible. Let's just say it's possible. Three, Babylon is the city of Rome or the restored Roman Empire. Four, it's Jerusalem. Okay. I've seen really good cases for Rome. I've seen really good cases for Jerusalem. I've seen really good cases for it being all false religion. And a lot of and I guess the fifth option is it's some combination of some or multiples of them. I do not take a dogmatic stand on that because I really don't know. I've heard convincing arguments from different people, and I would say read it and make up your own mind because. It certainly, whatever it is, it certainly involves false religion, and it certainly involves government power. The picture we'll see later is of the woman riding the beast, and so a lot of people have said, okay, because the woman is associated, the whore Babylon, the fornicatress, is associated with the city Babylon and the woman is false religion, and the beast is governmental power, and so the woman riding the beast is false religion being united with governmental power. Well, I mean, I think that's true, whether that's the correct interpretation of that or not, that false religion does unite itself to government power, and government power does try to co-opt religion. So that's true, whether that's the right interpretation or not. But other people say, well, maybe they're the same thing. Maybe we're making a false differentiation. I'm not giving you a lot of clear answers tonight, am I? This is hard material. And you know what? I don't want to you know blow smoke and make you think that we have definite answers where we don't, because we don't. And I don't feel like being dogmatic on these things. I think there are some things we can be pretty. Oh, okay. Verse 9, let's do verses 9 through, let's just get through this section, verses 9 through 12. And another angel, a third, followed them, saying in a great voice. Okay, now wait a second. We got a great voice now. Oh, we had a great voice back in chapter 7. Okay, oh, but the second angel doesn't get a great voice. Oh, poor second angel. It's like all middle children just get ignored, don't they? The poor second angel doesn't get a big voice. Okay, so it said in the great voice, if someone worships the beast in his image and takes a mark upon his forehead or upon his hand, he will drink out of the wine of the passion of God, which is mixed, unmixed, in the cup of his wrath, and they will be tormented in fire and sulfur before holy angels and before the Lamb. And the smoke of their torment goes up into ages of ages, and the ones worshiping the beast in his image. And if someone takes the mark of his name, have not paused day and night. Okay, so that's really not easy to read or understand. Chapter 12, here is the patience of the holy. Lots of material. You may want to read that in your own. In fact, let's just for sake of my literal is, it's good Greek and bad English. Okay, so a third angel followed them and said in a loud voice, if anyone worships the beast in his image and receives his mark on the forehead or on the hand, he too will drink of the wine of God's fury, which has been poured full strength into the cup of his wrath. He will be tormented with burning sulfur in the presence of the holy angels and of the Lamb, and the smoke of their torment rises forever and ever. There is no rest day or night for those who worship the beast and his image, or for anyone who receives the mark of his name. This calls for patient endurance on the part of the saints who obey God's commandments and remain faithful to Jesus. Okay, so I think that what we have here, especially the NIV does a really good job of making that readable. I think that it misses some stuff where the kind of the play on words John says, where John says he's mixed the wine unmixed, which is, you know, whatever. But we know what verse 12 means. We know what verse 9 means. And most of this is fairly well understandable, right? We see this image in verse 11, the smoke of their torment goes up forever and ever. We're going to see this imagery repeated. This is straight out of the Old Testament. So the Old Testament talks about the destruction of Babylon, and how does it describe it? The smoke rises forever and ever. We see this later in chapters, I think, 18, and maybe it's mentioned in 19. We see the smoke rising forever and ever. This is, not only is this Old Testament imagery, but this is a mockery of the smoke of the incense rising from the tabernacle. Remember we saw that earlier where there was the smoke of the incense that rises? Well, here it's the smoke of the destruction, the sulfur and the burning of those who reject God and the Lamb. And that smoke rises forever and ever. So it's a dark, ironic twist on what is good. And again, this is straight out of the way John thinks. John has two main ways of understanding the world, and I think I've mentioned these before, but John sees things either in extreme opposites or John sees things in synthesis. Now, you would say, well, maybe that's just a really well-rounded way of thinking. Well, it probably is, but John sees things in opposites. There is the kingdom of God and there's the kingdom of the world. There's heaven and there's earth. There's the flesh and there's the spirit. John sees things in these extreme opposites. They're sometimes called dyads, is one of the terms you might have seen or heard before. John gives us those. And Revelation here is full of those things. But John also synthesizes ideas. So what he does is he takes those dyads, he takes those opposites, and he uses them to play off of one another as foils. And so he says, well, they both have the smoke rising forever and ever. So there's the world, and then there's the saints, and then there are the lost, and then they both receive a judgment of some kind, and smoke rises forever and ever out of this. John also does synthesis, right, where Jesus is the Son of God and the Son of Man. So he does things like that, but understanding that John likes to use opposites is really the question is when is this stated? Because we've got a timeline issue here in chapter 14, and I think that it's good to notice that we've got a timeline issue. But again, we had a timeline issue in chapter 12. Chapter 12, we have going way back in time talking about the birth of Christ, or at least the birth of the church. And then we kind of skip forward and move a couple thousand years in the future and talk about the rapture and what happens right after the rapture, 3.5 years into the tribulation. Here we kind of have the inverse, I think, where chapter 1 fast forwards us to chapter 18 right before the destruction, I'm sorry, verses 1 through 5, and then verse 8 takes us all the way up to chapter 18, where Babylon the Great has fallen, and Jesus is on Mount Zion with the 144,000, with his saints. So, there are some people who will tell you that Revelation fits a perfect timeline that never breaks. It doesn't, though. John doesn't write everything in perfect order. None of the prophets did. Read the Old Testament prophecies. Nothing is in perfect order. That doesn't mean it's bad. It just means that there's some work we have to do. Now, you could disagree with that, and you can say, well, no, he'll come back up to heaven, and, well, flew back, I guess, maybe, and he'll come back again. I mean, you can say that, but I don't think it does you any good. Is Babylon? I think we have better answers, which is Revelation doesn't always give us. If you don't like it, that's okay. I'm wrong a lot. So, verse 12. Here is the patience of the holies. Now, I think the NIV and I'm not sure what the King James has, but it probably has something like this requires the patience or this demands the patience of the saints. It says something like this. Because it seems to be what this says is that it is going to require patience on behalf of the saints to not receive the mark. There's going to be tremendous pressure for these people who have the seal of God on their foreheads to not receive the mark of the beast on their foreheads or on their right hands. Why? Well, we already know. We've been told they can't buy or sell if they don't receive the mark of the beast. They're not going to be able to live, essentially. They're going to be cut off from the world's economy, and so they're going to be in dire straits, and so this is going to take patient endurance on the part of the saints. And we know that it's the saints because it says the holies and the ones keeping the commandments of God and the faith of Jesus. So is keeping the commandments of God and keeping the faith of Jesus the same thing? I don't know. Something for you to think about. Any other questions or comments before we move forwards, or do we feel... All right, so let's do verses 13 through 15 here real quick. And I heard a voice in the heaven saying, write, blessed are the dead ones in a Lord dying from now. Yes, says the Spirit, so that they will pause out of their labor, for their works follow with them. And I saw, and behold, a white cloud, and upon the cloud was one sitting, similar to a son of man, having upon his head a golden crown, and in his hand a sharp sickle. And another angel came up out of the temple, crying in a great voice to the one sitting upon the cloud, send your sickle and harvest, because the hour to harvest came, because the harvest of the earth is ripe. Let's do verse 16 as well. And the one sitting upon the cloud cast his sickle upon the earth, and the earth was harvested. Okay, so, wow. Again, a lot of timeline stuff that's really hard to sort through. So verse 13 says, blessed are the ones who die in the Lord from now on. Were the ones who died in the Lord before not blessed? this is a really strange statement, right? Were they not blessed? Yes, says the Spirit, so they will pause out of their labor. Okay, so if we go back to chapter 2, verse 2, you'll notice I got that little footnote there. In chapter 2, 2, we see a similar term where he says, I know your deeds, your hard work and your perseverance, I know you cannot tolerate wicked men, etc. I know your hard work is how the NIV translates it. That's that word labor. They'll pause from their labor. I know your deeds. We saw that, I know your deeds, repeatedly, over and over and over. But here, they'll pause from their labor. Now, if you notice that word pause, we just saw this a little bit ago, right? There was a pausing of the suffering, right? There's no pause from the suffering. Is that, yeah, right there in verse 11. If someone, the smoke of their torment goes up, and if anybody takes, their torment will go up forever, if they and it will not pause day and night. It'll be unceasing. So we see, again, this parallelism. It's very deliberate. He's playing off of itself. It's saying, look, everybody who is taking the mark of the beast, those who will not, will be refused the ability to buy and sell, those who are going to be persecuted, He says, blessed are those who are dying in the Lord from now on. Well, wait a second. They weren't blessed before? Of course they were blessed before. What he's saying is, he's reiterating something we should already know. By the way, I think that this is one of these reasons why we recognize that Revelation was written not even primarily for us. Well, the book of Revelation is important to us. You guys are all here. It clearly is important to you. But the book of Revelation will be most important to people who are living through the tribulation. It will be a guide for them, and it will be an encouragement and a blessing for them. Why? Because they're going to be living through it. People are actually going to be tempted and threatened to take the mark of the beast. And what are they going to do? They're going to read verse 13, and they're going to read, blessed are the ones who die in the Lord from now on. And it's going to encourage them to not take the mark of the beast because they're going to be tempted. And they're going to remember, yeah, the ones that take the mark of the beast, they are going to suffer ceaselessly forever and ever. However, the ones who say yes to the Lord, the ones who refuse to receive the mark, what happens? They pause out of their labor. Some of them have unpausing misery. These ones pause out of their hard work and out of their labor, and their works will follow with them, which is a reference directly to what we saw in chapter 2, right? I know your deeds. You'll be rewarded for your deeds. So again, we're seeing the same themes that are crossing. So does this mean that we're talking about the church here? No, but it means that God is going to treat the tribulation saints very similarly, if not the same way that he treated any question? Oh, well, I'm sorry. We have to do verse 14 here. So we got the cloud. I'm just going to throw it out to you guys. Who's the one? Yes, he's similar to a son of man. So is he a son of man? Yeah, I don't know what to do with that. And I didn't say like. I mean, I'm not like bragging here, but I'm looking up the word here. Verse 14. And I saw one dressed in white, and he was homoion. Normally, the word that John uses is the word hos. It's just omega sigma, hos. And that's the word for like or as. That's the routine word. But here, he uses homoion. So you guys, you may be aware of, homeostasis. Homo means the same. Homoi means similar or like. I don't know that there are any common English words that use homoi, but anyways, it means similar. It doesn't mean the same. So, okay. So he's like a son of man, but he's got a golden crown on his head. Does that help us at all? Gene, you really look like you want to answer and don't want to answer at the same time. Yeah. Yes. Absolutely. He's somebody of great importance. Okay. Could it be the Holy Spirit? Well, the Holy Spirit is one in being with the Father and the Son. He proceeds from the Father and the Son. With the Father and the Son, he is worshipped and glorified. So he would be similar to a son of man, maybe. He certainly is worthy of wearing a crown because he is God. It's a possibility. It's a possibility that it's Christ. I mean, Christ is the son of man, but he's also similar to a son of man. So that wouldn't be false. Could it be, I mean, it's got to be somebody with tremendous power. Now, but none of these things necessitate it being Jesus, right? But I don't know that there's any place where angels are described as being like. One wouldn't think so. Now, there are places in the Old Testament, though, there are places in the Old Testament where it seems to be that angels take the form of men, but with that term son of man is very distinct. It's very specific. Go ahead, Dan. No, and that's another issue. And thank you for pointing that out. Yeah, the angel. I don't think the word "another" necessarily means that this is an angel. You could interpret it that way, but we've had so many angels mentioned already that I don't know that that's a great argument that it's another. But the fact that he gives an order, if would Jesus need to take orders from an angel? No, but. But yeah, exactly. I don't know. It's really difficult, and I don't know what to do with this. I don't know what to do with this. There are a couple places here. There's another place where there's an angel that's described. I don't think we've come to it yet in Revelation, and there's a big question of whether that angel is Jesus or not. And I'm sure we'll talk about that when we get there. But what is significant is whoever this is someone who harvests. Now, when we go back to Matthew and we read about the parable of the net, right? The good fishes and the bad. Several times in Matthew, and I don't remember all the parables where it happens, Jesus says that it's the angels who are going to sort out the good from bad. Jesus says at the end times, God will send his angels, and his angels will do the harvesting, his angels will do the sorting. So my guess is, if we go back to the Gospels, this is an angel. Excuse me. But like Jim said, whoever this angel has to be an extremely powerful and important angel for him to wear a crown and to be the one who has all of this authority, and he's described as being like Jesus. So throw it out there. Could it be Michael? Michael's name means who is like God. I don't know. Could be. I don't know. I don't think that's a very good argument, but, you know, whatever. But we know that it's ripe. Well, wait a second. Again, he cast his sickle on the earth, and the earth was harvested. What the world? We've got a bunch more chapters to go here. How are we supposed to sort this out? I don't know. Let's keep reading this chapter and see if John makes things any. Verse 17. Let's just go ahead and finish this section here. And another angel came out of the temple. Man, how many angels are we going to have? And another angel came out of the temple in the heaven, having, he also, a sharp sickle. Oh, great. So we've got another sickle angel. Okay, cool. And another angel came out. How many angels are there? Another angel came out of the altar, the one having authority upon the fire, and he voiced a great voice to the one having the sharp sickle, saying, "Send your sharp sickle and reap the grape clusters of the vineyard of the earth, because its grapes are prime." And the angel cast his sickle into the earth and picked the vineyard of the earth and cast it into the winepress of the passion of God, the great winepress. And the winepress was trodden outside the city, and it went out blood out of the winepress under the bridle of a horse. If you guys have any guesses, I'm ready to take it. This is definite Old Testament imagery. This is definite imagery of the final judgment of God. But why is it here? Why is this material here when we've got, you know, look at chapter 15. What do we see in chapter 15? There are seven angels with seven, and then they do these, they send these plagues, and then there's the tabernacle of the testimony was open, and the seven plagues come out, and chapter 16 give us the seven bowls of wrath, and then chapter 17 we have the woman on the beast. We see mystery, Babylon the Great in verse 5, who's riding upon the beast. And then we get to chapter 18 and we see the fall of Babylon. I don't know what to do other than I think that what's happening, and this is just, take it for what it's worth. If you say, Luke, I don't believe you, I think you're wrong, I very well may be. But it seems to me that what's happening in chapter 14 is, starting in chapter 12, we kind of took a pause. And John is giving us this kind of broad strokes image of the last 3.5 years. He's throwing all of this Old Testament imagery at us, and he's telling us what's going to happen. He's going to give us the main characters, which he does in chapters 12 and 13. He gives us the unholy Trinity. Then in chapter 14, he gives us kind of an advanced timeline of what's going to happen. And it's not in order, and we shouldn't take it to be in order. But he's giving us this. Why doesn't he give it to us in order? I have no clue. But this is the best answer I have. If you guys have a better answer, and I'm not being smug, if you guys have a better answer, I would love to hear it, because I've never. Yes. Yeah. And what? Go ahead. Yeah. What may be? And I'm just, again, throwing this out there. If you don't think it makes sense, maybe it doesn't. But if this book isn't written for us, primarily, if this is primarily written for people who are going to come to faith during the tribulation, if this is primarily written for them, when the events of chapter 11 happen and there is the great earthquake in Jerusalem, they're going to pick this book up and they're going to start there and say, well, crap, We missed chapters 1 through 10. Yeah, we missed it. We screwed it up. Let's see what's happening next to see what happens next. And what they may do is, they may say, oh, well, I know who the dragon is. We figured that one out. We know who the beast out of the sea is. We know who the beast out of the earth is. So what should we expect? Oh, those 144,000. You might be one of the 144,000. Okay, well, I know who these dudes are. And then you see these angels and you see the harvest of the earth. Does it answer every question? No, I don't think so. I don't think it answers every question, but I think it's a plausible way of understanding why it would be written the way it is. Now, why are the events of chapter why are the events of chapter 14 completely out of order? As far as we know, I don't know. Or could they be written in order of importance? Maybe. It could be that if somebody wanted to do a detailed study, I will not do this. I've got other things to do, but maybe there's somebody who has done this. Maybe chapter 14 is in a chiasm. I know you guys have remembered, we've talked about chiasms before, right? Chiasm is where you have a theme or an idea that's at the first thing that's mentioned, and then it's also repeated at the end. And then you see these same ideas kind of mirror each other as you move forward, so you have like idea A, a repetition of idea C, idea B, idea A. It's really common in the ancient world. Chiasms are really common. They're used a lot. People are seeing them all over the Bible. It's kind of the hot new thing in biblical studies is to look and try to find chiasmus or chiasms. So maybe chapter 14 is in a chiasm, and I'm just not aware. Long story short, I don't know, and I'm not gonna make crap up. Well, I could. I'm not going to. No, resist the temptation, Luke. So, what do we do with this? I think that what happens is chapter 15 kind of picks up the narrative again. Maybe chapter 16, maybe chapter 15 should be a continuation of 14. We'll look into that. I think you can make a case either way. Definitely chapter 16 picks up the temporal narrative. I think we're out of time. Well, we are out of time. But I think we're out of the timeline because what did we have? We had the seven bowls. We had the blowing of the seventh trumpet. And then we didn't see anything mentioned that's a time marker until we get to verse 16. And then we see, go pour out the seven bowls of wrath. I think definitely in chapter, if not in 15, maybe chapter 15 does. But definitely by the time we get to chapter 16, we've re-entered the timeline again. One more time. I'll say it one more time. You're probably sick of hearing it. Why do we leave the timeline? Don't know. But I think it's fairly... What's that? Maybe he did. You know, maybe John did. Maybe God just wants to make things really hard so that we have to work for it. I don't know. You know? So, anyways, any final thoughts before we wrap up? All right. Well, thank you, guys, and God bless you. What's that?
One more day.
That's what Connie and Deanne were saying, is that... Got enough. So you're telling me it's not going to stay warm and beautiful for the rest of... What's that?
I've been reading Hitchcock.
Oh, yeah?